All right, here with Robin Woodall in Boise, Idaho. And if you would, Robin, you want to just give a quick introduction of you and what you do.
Okay, so I am, I don't even know what you'd call me. I'm a coach. I coach people who have eating disorders, emotional eating, obsessive exercise problems. You name it. I have a YouTube channel. I started in 2011 and I post sessions, between me and people that come, that reach out to me for help. I post those sessions on YouTube and, I've personally recovered from an eating disorder. And so I guess it kind of naturally occurred that as I started talking about my issues and talking to other people about their issues, it just attracted more people who had eating disorders.
And, an author?
I am an author. I keep on forgetting about that. And I'm currently, I'm currently writing another book, a couple more books actually, that hopefully will be published in the next couple of months.
And when I met you, you were running your gym, the Mind Body Method.
Tone Athletic Club, Tone Personal Training downtown. And then I started a Mind Body Weight Loss. And so, yeah, so I'm a personal trainer. I've got a degree in exercise science.
And, you know, I would call you one of the four, I mean, it might be just me saying this because I don't know a tremendous about, but I would call you one of the leading experts in using HCG.
I am. That's so, for sure. And it's also highly controversial because there's a lot of, it's been abused a lot. It looks like crap.
Yeah.
To people that don't use it as a medical procedure. It's a medical process.
If you go look for recipes. For
phase, yes, you phase do. One.
There's a lot of abuse out there.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. A lot of people come to me for guidance through the HCG protocol. A lot of doctors come to me to help with their clients. But my main focus at this point is helping people recover from the suffering and the darkness of an eating disorder.
And we had met each other. I had in January 2009. It was kind of brought to my attention that I might have an eating disorder, binge eating. And I had enough introspection to not just be defensive about it and really looked at the facts. And I was like, oh my gosh, this makes total sense. And indeed, I was like, I don't need a doctor to diagnose me here. It's pretty clear that that's the case. Immediately went and got therapy and found out, you know, the who, when, and why, and where all, how that all came to be, how I chose food is that, that coping mechanism and why it started, which is a huge, you know, that's a good first step. And then you came into the picture, through just, I mean, the timing couldn't have been better with the stars aligning, with me realizing that and what you were doing and you were looking for, you know, a male client who could, you know, be willing to go through this and learn. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of how we met through the radio station. And then I started, you know, doing the HCG and going through that for those, that probably 6-7 month period of time.
Yeah. And you ended up losing over 200 pounds. And even if, even though we were addressing, I would say we were addressing the outlier issues with just functional eating, emotional eating. Yeah. We didn't really address the issues with body image in part because I hadn't really evolved in my own coaching and the ability to put to words, the context. You know, if you read Weight Loss Apocalypse, you'll hear repeatedly, you need to be able to do this without it being about your weight. But since then,
it was gentle.
It was gentle.
It was gently put in there.
And, too gentle. Yeah, that's too, where the update needs to come out, where it's about how you feel about your weight and your body is a major, it projects into your relationship with food. So unless you deal with your strain with the body, the strain you have with food will always be there. Even so, by we could say we were looking at untwisting the strain you had with food until you untwist the strain with your body, it's always going to come back. And it did. It did for you, and it has for a lot of people.
It's and you know, obviously in that amount of time, a lot more research has been done. You've done more research. You've been doing a lot more different things. And so you learn, I don't even know if we ever talked about ghrelin as a hormone.
Oh, ghrelin, yeah. And leptin.
And the, how those things play. But that isn't necessarily the point of all this. The fact that, you know, I had you know, reached a point where I did lose all that weight. I mean, I was down to 225, something like mm-hmm. that. And it was great. The problem that happened for me is I fell in love. And so you get real distracted. And in fact, when we started dating, I was like, listen, I don't know how this is going to go because I'm in a real different place. You know, she had two kids and we ended up getting married and I adopted her kids. But, you know, in that period of time, you know, she was very supportive, but you get distracted with different things and you kind of, you move on, and that's pretty much what happened. And then it just is a slow thing. It didn't happen overnight for sure. But those elements of, I think, dysfunction, were still there when it came to food mm-hmm. and my lack of understanding of what that relationship was. Because, I don't know if you remember from some of our, you know, our meetings and things, I vilified food. I wanted to find an enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was easy to market as food as being the problem. And so as we get into the gist of this podcast and the fact that, you know, about 6 months ago, I had decided that, listen, enough is enough. You know, my wedding ring doesn't fit anymore and I feel miserable. I've got 3 herniated discs. Those feel miserable. My body just was, I was like, that's bad. I'm on medication for high blood pressure. And so all of these things, I was just like, it's time to really get back to it. And I'm obviously not done with this, and could see a few moments where really it was the mental aspect of it, you know, with my mom going through Alzheimer's, and I just felt like I was numb to a lot of stuff. And that's when I decided I need to make a change. And I had tried a few things here and there, but I always knew in the back of my mind, there's only one way to really get down to the bottom of it. And that is to strip away everything and go from meal to meal and focus in on the hunger aspect of it and what's going on. And so I created this hashtag Metallica diet idea. I threw in a couple of things when I started this out to, you know, kind of point me in the right direction, because I knew that I was going to have a lot of people come at me and say, hey, I can help you do this. I can help you lose 100. I had a lot of amazing people reach out to me, a couple doctors who were experts in internal medicine. Mm-hmm. I had some, you know, pretty, you know, people high up in the nutrition world and exercise world that wanted to help me. And I was like, I really appreciate everybody who was reaching out to do it. But I'm like, that's not the bag here. That's not what I need to do. And as we went through it, I'd realized at the first couple months, I was like, well, the first thing I'll do is make sure I get a good month or so of just cutting out food and really focusing in on how much I'm eating. And so that was really successful for the first month. Then I thought, you know what, I'll do the keto thing just to, you know, start generating that weight loss.
Well, it's super popular. It's like,
it's popular, but, you know, I mean, the aspect to me, I was like, listen, I understand complex carbohydrates and what they do to your body. And so I was like, you know, why not just take those out?
Yeah.
What happened though, while the first few weeks that I did that was super successful. I mean, I lost some weight, but I was focusing again in on the food and not what I was needing to do. And so I immediately just cut that out.
Yeah. Like, again, the demonizing of food is a huge problem in why the diet industry is such a failure in terms of long-term weight loss. They are blaming the food for the problem.
Yeah.
And that's not the case, right?
No. And so it was right after I had this revelation, I think, that really produced a lot of clarity for me. And I was in doing I don't know if I had started to do the keto thing necessarily. I guess I was in the middle of it. But I was at home. I was in my chair. I was watching TV or something. And I was like, oh, you know, I need a bag of popcorn. And I was playing video games. That's what I was doing. It's my other passion. And so I was playing video games, like, you know, I could use a bag of popcorn. And I almost got out to get it. And I was like, wait a second, I'm not hungry at all. Why do I want popcorn? And I started to kind of unravel this. And I had gotten a day off. I was on a day off from work. And the next thing you know, I was like, oh, I'm really anxious. I was feeling unbelievable anxiety because I had the day off. And the reason that happens for me, I love my job. It's one of those kind of things where you love to be there, but a lot of cool stuff happens at work that you might not, you know is happening, you want to be part of. And I was feeling that. It was a minute kind of thing when you look at it in the grand scheme of things, but I was feeling anxiety because I wasn't at work. That's why I was about to go up and get a bag of popcorn. And I was like, holy shit. I can't believe that just happened, because it wasn't like, I even had an opportunity to say yes or no to that. It was an automatic, I'm going to get up and go get popcorn kind of situation. And it, I realized right then and there that it wasn't the food. It was me. It was my mental, you know, it was those synapses or whatever you want to call them that, that was protecting me from feeling anxiety. Mm-hmm. Like I was protecting myself from feeling anxiety. And in order to do that, I would have to eat food. And I was like, this, that's messed up. And I got extraordinarily angry because I'm like, well, how often does this happen to me? It was so instantaneous, Robin. It was mind blowing. And I was like, all the things that that have happened here. And, you know, who knows how long, because I've been doing this for 30 years now, where I didn't have a choice. I didn't have a choice to choose whether I should be anxious about this or not. And the response to that was just, it blew my mind and made me very upset, especially because I had just lost my mom and the stuff he's going through with Alzheimer's. It was devastating. And I was really angry about it.
About feeling the need to eat?
About,
or not being conscious about it.
Not being conscious about
it. Yeah, that, but that's because you don't question or never have questioned that aspect. So for, it's so easy to question, oh, is it a carbohydrate or a protein? That's the bull crap that we're taught, not the reason. And you've always probably thought, well, when I'm eating emotionally, it's because I'm trying to get rid of a bad emotion. You've never thought that I'm eating to comfort myself, so for a positive reason.
Makes
sense. So a lot of people don't see that.
The positive and it's unconscious. And
it's, you know, it's coming from some type of like, well, that's what I do. That's what feels better. So yeah, that moment of clarity, it just takes a moment of question. And that's why the hunger scale to me, the way I used to approach it, that direction around, if you're not hungry, pause. It is helpful. It's super beneficial. But in the, if you don't have, if you're in a, and this is might be why it was clear, we weren't doing this. I know you wanted to lose weight for this Metallica diet, but the, there was quite a bit of work that where we were like, don't worry about your weight. Your weight isn't the issue.
Yeah. So when we were working together back in 2009.
Yeah, when you take weight out of the issue and you're not restricting for weight loss, why would you restrict? So, and if you, even the hunger scale is a form of restriction in relation to that anxiety.
Sure. Yeah. I realized through this moment that I had made terrible mistakes in this whole thing because, and that's when I realized, listen, I've been trying to vilify food and make it the enemy. So taking that approach from it, as opposed to taking myself outside of it, like I'm not the reason. What's the common denominator between me being overweight in 30 years? Me.
Yeah.
The food was there before and after. There's plenty of other people who walking around who aren't like that. Yeah. So,
well, people don't question their internalized belief systems, right? There's once you internalize an idea like food is comfort, emotionally, right? You don't, no one questions that as the issue. They're not necessarily seeing that as a problem. They're seeing I'm eating too many calories as an issue. So do you see how that's eating too many calories is a very superficial way to look at it. That's like someone who's ignorant looking from the outside going, you're eating too many calories, you know, pointing at you,
right?
Not realizing, no, actually, of course you could say that's true, but that's the end result of someone who's eating to mask underlying fear.
It's the symptom, not the actual disease itself.
So then you have to question, well, where's the source of the fear, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not why am I eating? It's why do I have anxiety? And you did it naturally, which is why you had that moment of, oh, this is what it's supposed to be like.
Yeah, and you know? It was huge. And I use that, you know, throughout this entire time now just as a waypoint to be like, listen, you know, the fact that it changed on me in a little bit where I never really experienced that before. And I think that that's kind of, you know, I'd always, you know, associated the binge eating part is like the big binges where I would go crazy nuts, how I ended up getting here.
Yeah.
And instead of the little tiny things like that, you know, I wasn't, you know, looking for them and I wasn't thinking about them. And so now that I had that there, I realized a couple things. One, especially as the Metallica diet thing got a bunch of attention from people, is that I haven't made myself clear in the fact that, you know, my mission here is to recover from emotional eating, not to meet Metallica.
Yeah.
And so I realized a couple things probably got into the middle of the summer when I realized, oh, hey, you know, losing the weight isn't the actual, those aren't two, you know, exclusive items. It's not like I lose the weight and then realize I'm recovered. It's the other, it's not even the other way around. It's just focusing in on the mental aspect. And I'm like, whoa, I'm going to maybe disappoint a bunch of people because I don't know if I'll actually get to 100 pounds down thinking that way, because I had stopped doing the keto and went in full unrestricted, just like I was living, but using the hunger scale and analyzing every time I was hungry and eating food of what was going around with me emotionally.
Yeah.
And, you know, I realized a couple things. One, I had a lot of anxiety and that, you know, I didn't really realize that, and some depression. But to me, the interesting aspect of that whole popcorn situation was I realized I had anxiety and I dealt with it. Like, I understood where it was coming from. And once I understood why I felt anxiety and where it was coming from, it went away.
Naturally. Yeah. Because you addressed it and you sat in it. And then you're not, you know, what are you hiding from? You're, it's almost like, well, I'm not, I don't have to hide anymore. Because anxiety is a manifestation of fear. You know, that's what it is. So once you face something, oh, I was afraid I was going to miss it, miss something. Well, what am I losing if I miss something? Someone else will deal with it. It just immediate, because you're addressing it. You can handle it. You can handle the fear, right?
Yeah.
You don't have to handle it by avoiding it. You can handle it by experiencing it and addressing what it is, where it's coming from.
I'm an adult now. I can handle some things. But, you know, we had kind of talked about this just briefly on the phone together at one point, and it is like kind of, you know, you're relearning how to deal with some of those issues because you've never faced some of them before.
No,
you protected yourself.
This goes back to codependency.
Yeah.
Codependency is when you, we're all dependent, right? Dependency is healthy. We're dependent. My kids are dependent on me. I'm dependent with my husband. He is with me. We're working together as a team. You depend on each other. That's not a problem. That actually is to our favor, especially when it comes to survival and protecting each other. But codependency is different. Codependency is when you rely on something so much that it's a weakening process to the point where your capacity is weak and incapable if you let go of the crutch or what you're codependent on. So what you're addressing is your codependency with food to deal with anxiety, to deal with loneliness, to deal with, to magnify your life and to make it bigger than it really is. And when you remove that coping mechanism, right, you're forced to feel the underlying insecurity and weakness. And that's probably what you were feeling too, and what you've gone through at different times, is the feeling of I can't handle this, which is really what underlies all anxiety and fear.
Yeah.
I can't handle something. And so to remove any codependent relationship, whether it's a codependent relationship with a person, a substance, a behavior, you've got to be willing to be weak and be okay with it and allow it. And you got to be okay with failure and inadequacy. And that kind of goes against our human nature. Our human nature is driven to survive. But in order to develop your capacity without the need for a codependent crutch, you got to be able to, number one, you got to be okay with your weakness. You cannot, you can't feel bad about it or judge yourself. It's okay. I remember when I recovered, I felt like I was a four years old emotionally. I was in my 20s, but emotionally, I was about like a 4 year old because I was told what to do my whole upbringing, all this codependency on other people. When you remove that, all of a sudden you're left with what you're, where you're at. And so when you get rid of something like food, all of a sudden, how do you deal with, you know, someone criticizing you, judging you, loneliness?
I was a moody bitch.
Yeah, it was like a withdrawal, you know?
for a couple months actually, and I'm sure my kids and my wife could attest to this. You know, I would let things get to me a little bit more, and I would be quicker to get angry at something. And while I was going through that, I was enjoying it, to be perfectly honest with you, because it's stuff that I hadn't really been feeling. And as, you know, we were approaching, you know, more getting closer to this Metallica show that's happening here in a few weeks, you know, that I had really gone dark on my social media because there wasn't really anything to talk about. It's not, I was saying, it's not a spectator sport, you know, mentally challenging yourself. And I didn't really know what to say to people because they're not going to understand. It's hard to get people to understand because I would get a lot of messages from people, you know, that were reaching out and saying, hey, I might have some of these issues. And my first response to them is two things. One, if you can, and you should look into getting therapy. Because ultimately, you know, a therapist is going to help you situate and find out some of those things if you do it right. And the second is to read Weight Loss Apocalypse. And I would tell them, you know, you don't have to buy into the HCG factors of this, but the information in there about the relationship with food and the codependency and the dysfunction that's there is really interesting and, you know, can help anybody who might not understand that thing exists.
Yeah, it's a good start point. But my current information is really, really important because no one questions their negative relationship with their body. No one questions that as an issue underlying all of this strain with food.
Well,
I think that's the right thing to do. I should be uncomfortable with my body because I should, you know, because my body's bad.
Yeah, and that's the thing that I think took me a little bit of time thinking about and getting to. And you know, some of these things that you've been talking about in your videos, acceptance, shame, and forgiveness.
Yeah.
Maybe not necessarily in that order, but, you know, it's. I had a moment here a couple weeks ago, right after I started doing the protocol, you know, flying. I hate flying. Well, there's a reason I hate flying, because I'm the big fat dude on the plane. Mm-hmm. And so there is a lot of anxiety in that. But in this particular case, I was like, I don't care. You know, I'm like, it's just the way it is.
It's just
the way it is. And whatever happens, happens. But on the way back, it came in a situation because what I hate is full flights. Boise, Idaho, that's pretty much all you're getting when you leave and come into town is a full flight. And so I was on the smaller airplane and sure enough, it's a near full flight. And my seat, I was sitting next to somebody. And, you know, inevitably, this is what happens in this particular case. The air crew came over and there was some other open seats. And so she asked if this other gentleman sitting next to me would want to move. She didn't look at me. She didn't say anything because she didn't probably want to cause a stir, you know. And yeah, that guy moved. Of course, he wants to get away from the fat sitting right next to the fat guy. And so I moved over to his seat in the window and there's a seat between me and the guy. So everybody's comfortable. But a couple things happened. One, I felt that shame. I mean, I felt like, oh man, I felt really bad.
Yeah.
I wanted to cry actually because it was like, God. And then I just kind of thought about it and I was like, listen, that's just the way it is.
It's not worthy of shame. Shame is one of the most toxic emotions to a human being. It is the source of most addiction and mental illness.
Yeah. And so I immediately was like, thinking back to a lot of your work that you've been doing, I was like, well, I've got to forgive myself for that because there's nothing I can do about it. It's the way it is. And look, we're all okay. I got a seat in between us. And if not, it's only an hour, 20 minutes that somebody has to deal with it. It's probably not the worst thing that's happening in their life.
Totally.
So,
and if it is, they are special.
Yeah.
they have a special need.
And it's one of those things that I continually mentally check myself and go, accept the things you cannot control.
Well, yeah. And you know, is this really something that needs to be accepted? I mean, really think about it. The underlying shame about your size, shame about other people's thoughts about your size and the impact it may have, not just on your life, but someone else's life, that shame is what pressurizes your relationship with food. That's where I have to be perfect, that perfectionism that comes in. And then, so all the shame you have with your weight projects into fear of food and strain you have with food. And as primitive animals, you're screwed because our wiring is such that our psychological behavior is wired to prioritize safety and security with food above all else. You cannot remove that from our human nature. So if you feel bad about your weight and you're projecting that onto a need to restrict food, you're going to have a magnified look at needing food. That's what happens to every single person listening to this podcast. Because we're evolved animals. We're animals and we're predictable. And no one questions that strain and shame about their weight as the underlying fire underneath everything. It really is.
Yeah.
how long have you had a feeling in your life that you needed to lose weight?
Oh, you know, probably. And the crazy thing is, you know, most of it.
Yeah.
Since I was a child. And, you know, looking back, I looked through high school. 17 is about where I really started to get out of hand with the binge eating. And
were you dieting at that time or trying?
Probably.
Or preparing to?
Probably.
When people begin to implement a restriction, that's typically when they start to binge. Those binges get bigger.
Yeah, from the age of 16 or, you know, till about 19 or so. I had, you know, I mean, I think that was the height of the dysfunction of my family. And so that had a lot of, I think, to do with it. And looking back, you know, you look pictures in high school and you're like, listen, I wasn't really that fat anyways. I just projected it upon myself from somewhere, and it kind of spiraled out of control then, because, you know, when I was, I had always kind of looked at myself as overweight. Doctors don't help. Certainly,
no,
because
they're,
you know, they say, okay, here's what you should be, what the weight you should be at, the height you should be. And so, you know, I played football in high school, and I was, you know, way over 250, but it wasn't a bad thing for football necessarily. But it certainly, you know, my mom was like, oh, we should probably do something. I ended up going on a liquid diet. I was 16. And so I didn't eat food for 6 weeks. Well, I lost a bunch of weight. I also lost a gallbladder. Mm-hmm. And
did you in any way after losing weight think I deserve to eat?
I have no idea. There's no way I could remember that. Probably.
Well, go back and just think about what it felt like when you lost that weight. You were probably like, yeah, I did it. You know, I feel better emotionally about myself, but it comes at a high cost. You can't participate with food. Other people around you are all eating, isolated from it. You know, just think of how that creates this, almost there's an anger or self-defensiveness with food.
Well, I looked at it here's the problem is that I probably looked at it as a victory because I went 6 weeks without eating food and I had the discipline to do that.
Did you, after the fact, think I can celebrate, I can eat what I want?
I don't remember. Probably. Probably did. It didn't take long. And it was after that. I mean, I've been through all the diets. I mean, you know, as a kid, as a 17-year-old going into a Weight Watchers meeting, you're the only 17-year-old dude there. And there's a bunch of 35 and 40-year-old women. It would have been a great place to pick up ladies, actually. But I, you know, I wasn't thinking that way at the time. It was bad. It was demeaning.
Yeah,
it was demeaning.
There's something wrong with you, and if you go and you don't lose weight, you must have done something wrong, or something's wrong with your body. There's always this badness associated to your weight. And again, you know what? It goes back to the height and weight charts that were published in 1942. Before that, there was no black and white line around your unhealthy and healthy weight.
Sure.
It didn't exist. And it was created not by doctors, not by science, not by physiologists. It was created by an insurance company that hired a statistician to try to create a correlation, but easy measurements to disease so that they could sell insurance.
Yeah.
So they basically, how's that sound hearing that?
It's bad. It's bad.
It has changed. It created such a huge industry, the fear of being unhealthy weight. So someone the day prior has no symptoms, is totally fine. All of a sudden they're asked, oh, are you healthy? Are you healthy weight? They go get measured and guess what? Oh, you're not healthy. So you could get disease and die. And so it was a visible indication of disease back then. And so it became stigmatized. So people who had body fat or were larger were stigmatized as diseased. And then the diet industry came in. And let me tell you, if they knew what now, statistically, that anybody who diets, pretty much 98% of everybody who diets is going to gain more weight after the fact. They didn't tell you that stuff. So what was promoted is if it was easy and everybody loses weight and it's so easy and
it's fun.
Yeah. And it's great.
It's
everybody
so much. We're having
so
fun.
And they're still marketing that crap like this. And then when you're not doing well, the 98% of everybody doing it isn't succeeding. They don't blame themselves. They don't blame the diet industry. They don't blame the horrible marketing that's a lie, they blame themselves. So that internalized
I must
shame,
have done something wrong. Yeah. Everybody else is successful. Well, I did something wrong.
Well, not only are you as the dieter thinking there's something wrong with me or there's something wrong with my body, people who've never tried to diet and they see that marketing and it's like, oh yeah, it's like dogma. They don't question that you just gave an authority to these people. Like, if, oh, they know, you know, these diets that say you can put use tapeworms or here's an amphetamine. Oh, you're basically people believe it. And then when they see that you are struggling, you're the problem because that commercial, they said it was easy.
Right.
So you must be lazy. And so the stigmatization of people with body fat began after World War II. This hasn't always been this way.
No, and then I mean, you could probably draw a correlation along with that to if you go into the Warhawk Museum and here in Nampa, Idaho, and you see the uniforms that the soldiers wore. Go, those things are small.
Yeah.
People were tiny. People were so tiny in the 40s, in the 50s. And now that's not the case at all. It's the exact opposite.
They say, 50% of our country is trying to deprive themselves of food at any given time. And the same people in preparation for the famine and after the famine are overconsuming. Is it really the famine? I mean, where's the issue? Is it the overconsumption or the famine that is encouraging this pre-eating and post-eating? You know, so there's so much science out there to show that not just the shaming of weight and stigmatizing weight increases blood sugar instantly.
We need that.
Yeah, you're in fight or flight.
Yeah.
You're as if your body is the bear attacking you. Your body is a source of potential rejection and abandonment. So you're in perpetual fight or flight. This is not new science. This science has been here for a long time. If you're in fight or flight, your blood sugar is higher because it needs to be. If you just in case you need to run from a bear, but you're high in blood sugar just being anxious about your weight.
Yeah.
So when you look at the sensitivity then to food, if someone's in shame about their weight, they're more likely to gain weight just because of the shame.
It's crazy.
Oh, there's so much more. There's so much more. It's all going to be in the book I'm going to publish. But it's unfortunate because you're blamed as the problem, not the stigmatizing and shaming, which is really primitive. It activates our primitive pack animal fear of rejection and abandonment. That's a real trigger to fight or flight. And then you're told you have to restrict food, which is triggering the primitive first hierarchy of our psychological need, which is to feel safe with food. So you have two you have two primitive mechanisms basically intertwining and competing for who's going to get fulfilled first. What, your primitive needs to be loved and to be included, or the primitive need for food? Which one's going to win, you know?
So how do we unravel it?
Well, the goal is that you stop feeling bad about your weight. Because if you didn't feel bad about your weight, what would happen to your strain with food? So this is where people who are don't really understand it are going to make an assumption that if you don't have control over your food, you're going to binge. That's not true, is it?
Well, and I was, because I'm in the middle of the protocol right now. So, you know, obviously it doesn't get much more restrictive than that.
Yeah, but this is different. We've approached this differently.
Right.
This isn't a diet.
Exactly. But, you know, in looking at it from that point of view, of course, the kids just had a Friendsgiving over at the house. And so, you know, we helped out and they did all the cooking and everything. But, you know, somebody brought over this pretty, you know, badass looking green bean casserole. And I'm like, oh, man. And I put a note on it. I would like to try that someday. But just because you put some of that in front of you doesn't mean you have to have, you know, all of it.
No, well, you know, there is something to say for, you know, the fact that because we have this ingrained, it's hardwired need to feel safe with food. The problem isn't being around food so much as feeling that you are deprived, that I am being withheld. So those emotions are very much tied to emotional eating. The victim positionality is what I call it. Oh, I'm a victim. I can't eat it. Poor me. You're going to get it. You're going to get that food because you're wired primitively to do that. That's not a personal lack or inability. That's primitive wiring that's manifesting, right?
Yeah.
So the problem isn't the impulse to eat. It's, why do you feel sorry for yourself? Why are you in a position of being victimized? This is another reason why the hunger scale is such a great kind of gives you, it allows you to understand where you're at. Because if I'm not hungry, why am I feeling deprived? Is it lack of connection? Is it participation? But if you're, again, going back to that kind of competition between the, you know, what I'm referring to is Maslow's hierarchies of need. You can look it up. Basically,
I had to. I had to when she mentioned it in a video. I had to go look it up.
A nice fat chapter in my book because it's so relevant to this. Because we're primitive animals. It takes, they say, like 8,000 years to evolve. And like the last thing evolved over the 8,000 years is hair color, right? So our overall psychological drive is no different than our ancient ancestors who lived in the wilderness in tribes of 20 to 30 people. And, you know, evolutionary psychologists suggest with Maslow that, you know, our basic fundamental survival needs are continuously, even today in our first world luxury, driving much of our behavior.
Well, you could break it down to word greed.
That means you are insecure. It's a sign of insecurity, hoarding.
You want to gather all the food. And I've seen that in my household too, where we get every now and then, maybe somebody was like, hey, that's mine. Those are my leftovers. What are you doing? And I'm like, oh boy, let's take it easy here.
To go around. Well, and some of that is, it's like, should we judge it? Should we be here demonizing the fact that this is how we're wired?
That does no good. It's the way it is.
It is right? The way it is. Yeah. So, you know, when you look at, you know, you're on this medical protocol that does require significant removal from food. Based on this science, you know, of just our overall mechanisms, we could say this is quite dangerous to do. It's going to stimulate some of these primitive mechanisms to get food. However, what they found with research is when, depending on the reason someone is restricting, it changes how their relationship with food responds. They studied three groups that had the same exact food restriction. And the first group did it as a spiritual fast for spiritual reasons. No weight loss was measured. It wasn't, body image wasn't discussed. It was, we're going to do this for, you know, for a spiritual reason. The second group was about weight loss, and they were removed from all access to any other food. They were in controlled environments where there was nothing else but the food allotments and the food they on this diet. The third group was for weight loss as well, and they were surrounded by other food, had to eat with other people, had to smell all the other foods. And what they were studying was cravings and emotional eating and binge eating impact. Which group do you think, Jeremy, which group do you think had the worst cravings and the worst binge eating problems?
Probably not the spiritual group of people.
Nope, they had no issues, not even one.
Yeah. No, but they didn't care.
Well, because they weren't being deprived. Right. It was, I'm willfully giving this up for a cause.
Right.
It was meaningful. So the benefit was a spiritual thing. So between the second and third group, completely removed from all access, no smelling, no seeing anybody else eating, or I see everybody eating, I can smell what they're eating, and I'm left with this little bit of food. Who do you think had the worst feelings of victimization?
Probably the restricted and seeing everybody else.
Correct.
You know.
So being surrounded by food while you're depriving, they believe, stimulates self-defense.
Give me the food!
Yes! And so we're going to sit here and shame people who are trying to lose weight so that you like them while you're eating a burrito right in front of them. We're going to tell them that they're bad people because they want to eat or they're eating in a closet. You know?
Yeah.
So the problem is the, you know, the reasoning too, it's why you're trying to lose weight, you know, is a big deal. So even if someone's trying to do it for health reasons, that's still an illusion of benefit. It's not intrinsic or like the spiritual fast.
It's an abstract thing to think about. And that's the struggle I had for a while when we were talking about it. And I was like, man, it's a difficult thing to think that, you know, just to kind of give it up and not care about those aspects. And, but at the same time, easy for me to do because, you know, I've kind of, I guess, you know, maybe be down after 42 years because I'm 42 and I'm like, I'm still a fat person. And I'm like, that, I mean, what if that doesn't change? Okay, it's the way it's been forever. Mm-hmm. So why does that matter? Mm-hmm. It really doesn't. And I didn't feel like I fit into the thin supremacy stuff because I never, you know, really contemplated or thought about those kind of things. And I was just like, this seems to me to be, I already feel like I'm kind of in that area where I'm like, I don't really have any designs on a certain way that I'm going to look or the amount of weight I'm going to lose. My focus in this whole thing has really been to recover from the emotional aspect, to get that back. And so I think that had a lot to do with the fact that as we got closer to this Metallica thing, I started to feel a lot of pressure, not because I was like, I might miss that goal and not get to meet Metallica. I didn't really, it's hard to tell somebody that you don't care about that, who's been paying attention.
I remember telling you, you need to accept that you might not get that right now.
And
you
I
can be realistic with what we're working on.
Yeah, and I did because I was like, that's more important than the Metallica aspect. It's helping other people understand that has been, and when you do this publicly like I have, you know, imagine you're trying to recover from binge eating disorder or an emotional or any eating disorder, and you have people that you don't really know from the public come up and ask you how much weight you've lost.
Yeah.
Oof. Or
forgive them.
Or your that. Kids are getting asked that.
Yeah.
Like that was one of those things. Well, I didn't think that through.
Yeah.
And it really didn't add any pressure because I just said, you know, I'm doing good.
I'm doing great.
I'm halfway there. I all these things that I would just kind of throw out there because it's too complicated to explain to somebody. And at the same time, my question though is when you have that thought of like not you know, not caring about what happens about the weight and the health issues and all those things, is there a line?
No,
there because how do you believe? Like, I can say that till I'm blue in the face, but how do you know that I really believe that? Like, that's the question I've had to ask myself several times. How do I know that I really believe that?
Well, I like to, and I think that's a very relevant, important question because what you're asking is my health and the body, is it really not about that? Is it, and when should it become about that? Well, it never was about that as you were eating for anxiety. It never was about that when you were bored and eating for fun and eating all the time. You know, it never was about that. So to all of a sudden make it about that, that's how the diet industry works. That's how they make so much money. They're making hundreds of millions of dollars on that. Like your weight is the problem. Hold on a second. That's not the problem. The fact that your body gains body fat is a beautiful, amazing system that's working perfectly. The fact that you're still alive today is a miracle. You're like bionic.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so to even look at that as if that's the problem is backwards. It's not. It's not a problem at all. Your body's functioning perfectly. We have to question what type of environment has promoted this evolved mechanism of fat gain. What type of environment is there? And, you know, Jeremy, one of the things that when I talk to clients who are morbidly obese or in your situation with binge eating, even anybody on the spectrum of eating disorders, is what would happen if you were thinner right now? If we could snap your fingers and give you the average body, what would change?
Well, I mean, that depends. Would my mental outlook on the way I'm approaching eating change?
You got it. Your relationship to food.
Yeah,
would it be
because
different?
Well, no. I mean, it might because I'm in the middle of doing this recovery thing. So
yeah, but it has nothing. Your body's physicality has nothing to do with how you're perceiving things. Your shame of the body does. But even if you were to go, you know, we could give you the most ideal body. The need for you to address this personal self concept is going to be there whether you're thinner or fatter or anything in between.
Yeah.
We have to take the condition of, we don't want to force an outcome. The goal is that you address these issues with the outcome unconditional. Because even if you're thinner, let's just say we could snap our fingers and put you back to 225 or 200 pounds. that doesn't change the way you're perceiving yourself and perceiving yourself in relation to other people, in relation to work. It doesn't change your right. self-concept. So in order for this to heal, you have to have a concept of who you are irrelevant to the state of the body. This would be like trying to understand who you are if you were blind. If you lost your eyesight, Jeremy, have I done this with you before?
Yeah, we talked about it on the phone.
Just go there, right?
Yeah.
If you were blind, so let's let the listener hear this. And you can't see your body, you can't see anybody else seeing your body. How would you think of yourself? Who are you? If you're completely blind, how would that change your self-concept, right? How much of you out there who are dieting and feeling horrible about yourself because you're ashamed of your size and weight, how much of that shame would just go away? Because there's no point. There's no point. You can't see your body. No one, you can't see what anybody else is
seeing. Other people could see your body.
You can't see that they see your they body, could. You know? So it's a real visible issue. It's a visible, what I call a visible disorder.
Well, yeah, you know, and I mean, honestly, the last few years too, we obviously in the industry, we do a lot of, you know, meet a lot of bands and things like that. And so you get a picture with the band. And for a while I was like, oh, I look terrible. And I really would shy away from pictures. And I really wouldn't smile in those pictures very much because I'm like, I look really fat next to this person. And so for a while, that was, I would stay away from pictures. And
where, how do you come to an end result of terrible? How does someone come to that judgment of I look terrible?
You gotta get extra width on the camera to fit me in. Right?
You have to believe there has to be an image of your mind of what is correct. That's called thin supremacy.
Okay. Well, so I was having some bouts of that. And then as I started to...
terrible bout to thin supremacy.
Well, there's being, you know, thin supremacy. And then there's like moderately thin supremacy.
Thinner supremacy. It's still...
And so, you know, as I started to go through this again, we just had a, you know, a pretty decent... sized rock star come through our studio, and I got a picture with him, and I was excited to take the picture, and I was smiling. I was like, this is great, because I didn't care.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I was like, well, I know how I'm going to look in the picture, but I don't care. That's who I am.
What does it matter?
And it's tough to tell people, like, listen, hi, my name is Jeremy. I'm an obese person, and then this is what you look like. You know, you don't think about it in that terms. You know, but you would think of with substance abuse and things like that, people going through that. And that's just kind of the acceptance part. You're like, this is how it is. And if something else happens, whatever.
Well, you got to get to a place where you can forgive yourself. One, I mean, this is where recovery is, accepting the damages that might have been done. This is no different than someone who cuts themselves and has scars everywhere, or, you know, this is, there's a visible outcome to how the body has responded, and you have to be okay with that. The next thing is you've got to be able to recognize that it's not worthy of shame. I like to compare this to torturing animals for fun. You know, what is worthy of shame? Shame, again, is it triggers the survival mechanism of being outcast, abandoned. You know, shame is a very serious emotion. What is worthy of shame, right? Is this really worthy of shame? Especially when you tell the story of how this happened.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no, I mean, it's, I was a kid,
yeah, you know, you had no other way of thinking about things.
It was a defense mechanism, to help me cope with the situation that I was in, and it became a habit.
Yeah. And you didn't even know that.
Right.
You didn't even know that until recently. Even though you've dieted and lost weight multiple times, large amounts of weight, regained, you didn't know that you had that coping mechanism. So you can postpone that coping mechanism while you're getting the benefits of the weight loss, you know, the reward of withholding yourself. But, you know, you've got to be able to surrender your coping mechanism, not because you deserve a reward. It's because you want to develop from within. You want to develop. It's like you want to reverse time and become a child again and redo it again. But why do that when you can just do it now?
Mm-hmm.
I call that updating your hard drive. We just need to update your hard drive. You have all this wisdom. today, you don't have to go back into your childhood and relive it. You can just start doing what you just, and it feels, I know for me, it felt like I was a kid. You got to be able to just start doing it, even though you might not lose weight. You shouldn't have to do it. You shouldn't have to be rewarded for evolving. You
right.
know what I'm saying? So this is where the body image stuff comes in.
Yeah.
Should I need to do it for health? No, of course not. That should be, no, this isn't about health. This is about you updating your hard drive. Like, oh, I've evolved. I've learned. I'm wiser. Why do I have to keep on doing what I needed to do as a child when I have the wisdom today, not only to understand the consequences of this coping mechanism into adulthood, but I have the wisdom to understand why I needed to cope, understand it, forgive it, give it grace, but also, you know, the ability to go back into those sense, the sense of fear and sit in it. I don't have to run anymore. I'm an adult, you know, or even if you're not, you're say you're emotionally 4 years old, like I was, what's wrong with being scared? You know,
yeah.
Tend to yourself, you know, why do we have yeah. to be ashamed of that, you know, and let it develop. But I can't remember what my point was. So, recovery.
Some people might misconstrue the fact that you say, listen, you know, worrying about the way you look and all these things means that you, in the process of this recovery, that's all there is to it. Do you know what I'm saying?
No.
They're saying, well, oh, that's real simple. Just don't worry about being fat.
Well,
because a lot of people might hear that.
It goes way beyond that. You right. have to not worry about someone shaming you, judging you, thinking, stigmatizing you, thinking you're ugly, dumb, uneducated. You don't want it.
Lazy.
You don't care.
Lazy.
That is, lazy.
Lazy.
Can't handle it, weak. They're literally making you an inferior human being. You got to be okay with narcissists that are out there walking around thinking that their shit doesn't stink.
Yeah.
And yours does. You have to be okay with that. You got to be okay with people thinking that you're dumb, you know, because they don't have context. They don't have understanding. They think they do. You can let them think that.
Yeah. It's a stereotype.
Yeah. Yeah. It stems from narcissism, which is a survival mechanism. So you have to be okay that some people suffer with narcissism and they don't even know it. You don't need to defend yourself to someone or appease someone who wants you to suffer, right? If you were to go in and let's just say that affected you and you're doing this so that people don't shame you, Jeremy, how's that going to end?
Oh, it's just going to start all over again.
You can't do it to prove yourself to someone else. You've tried that before.
Yeah.
You know, to say I'm not, you know, whatever it is, I'm trying to prove myself. This isn't about proving yourself. This is about just accepting yourself. You know, when you take your weight and remove the pressure, right? Just accept it. Accept it for what it is. Permanently, forever. If you can do that, even at 400 pounds, what happens to the strain you have with food?
Well, it disappears.
Yeah, because there's yeah. no badness. There's no badness pressurizing your relationship with it.
Yeah, there's not like, oh, looking at something on the table and be like, I can't eat that.
No, or how it manifests is I deserve it. I deserve it. I'm going to eat it. So a lot of people don't even realize they're thinking I shouldn't eat that. All they hear is I deserve it. I need it. I want it. That's the yeah. hard part is consciously they're aware they want more food, but they're not consciously aware of is that they feel shame about that food, that they feel that at some point I have to stop eating. A lot of the binge eaters I work with, have intense fear of food going away. Intense. It feels like they're going to die of starvation. I don't know if you have ever felt that way. Everybody's a little different, but
you might have felt it if you didn't eat. Yeah, maybe. I would call it hangry.
Yeah,
that's like if you went to way past where it would be acceptable on the hunger scale, like if you were at an 8 or 9 or something, that gets dangerous.
So anger is, in terms of consciousness, is unfulfilled desire. That means you are angry and you're going to get it. That means you're entitled and deserve. So that's an actual predictable state of unfulfilled desire. Desire comes from a wanting, a yearning. It always stems from I don't have enough. I'm lacking in some way. So a lot of people can feel that way, not just about food, but in different areas. So angry is like the manipulative way to force what you want so that you feel rewarded. So there, that means that you're coming from, I've worked hard, I've done something, I deserve a reward. Yeah. Again, don't feel bad about that. Those are survival mechanisms working perfectly under the circumstance.
What does recovery from an eating disorder look like?
Well, most people who have an eating disorder are...
It's clearly...
And it's bad.
Yeah.
It's eating disorders have the highest morbidity rate. That means disease and death of any mental illness. So it's a terrible thing. Recovery is awesome because you're coming from a complete horrible place, right? The process of getting to recovery is suffering more and then suffering some more. I mean, a lot of people who've recovered from any type of addiction would say the same thing. You got to suffer so bad. Recovery is amazing. You know, it's got to get real bad. So, but that bad, that darkening process, if you want to call it, is a lot of suffering. That's what it takes to get to the point of surrendering it all and letting it go. And, you know, the humility it takes to surrender and say, I can't do this anymore. And the willingness to let go of your codependency, the willingness to be frail, to be weak, to be judged, to be shamed. It's like that. It's a very humbling process. It's not a forceful process. I don't know if I'm describing
to be in the moment, to live in the moment,
your humility.
Yeah.
It's really removing the inflated ego, the pride of that, you know, narcissistic core of the survival ego. You know, ego is survival. Narcissism is survival. Our brain is wired to be self-serving, self-promoting, self-everything in that state. And so to recover from it, especially when it's been radical, when you're in a radical survival mechanism like binge eating disorder, anorexia, or anything in between, or any type of addiction, the recovery requires complete and total humility. It's like saying, I lost, I failed, I'm going to die, I'm willing to die. You know, it's a spiritual death, if you want to call it that. It's and without feeling sorry for yourself. You know, feeling sorry for yourself is the other side of the coin of narcissism, right? Poor me, I'm a victim, I have to be this way forever, boo. You know, that aspect has to be surrendered too. It's like saying, you're telling me, Robin, I have to be fat forever, and then you feel sorry for yourself. Well, what do you want? Do you want freedom? Because if you want freedom, is it really that bad? You know, you have to look at the criticism and the... Again, it's all positioned around that thinner ideology, mm-hmm. thinner dogma. Is it really that bad if you get rid of do you really want to be promoted because of thinnerness? Do you really want people to like you because you have, I'm thinner on my resume? I mean, you have to really get to the core of who you are, and that requires you strip away the fake concepts that you thought you were.
Yeah. And you know, the decision I made, you know, early on was like, listen, I guess I just have to not care if I'm going to get to meet Metallica or not. Mm-hmm. At least, here's the thing. I mean, that's a singular moment in time that will pass regardless of whether I get there or not. Like November 28th will come and go. I'm still, planning on being here. So, you know, my project and my goal is much bigger than that. And it was really, I think, while I think it was a mistake to, you know, put myself in a box where I have to lose 100 pounds, that clearly is not the way to approach recovering from an eating disorder, especially binge eating disorder. And you know, the pressure that I put on myself to make that goal, I look at it now as like, well, it's a great litmus test to see if I'm really in a place of recovery. If I'm willing to throw all that away, then I feel like I'm in a good place to be able to move on.
Well, and, you're comparing. I mean, it really is a matter of meeting some people that you appreciate. I mean, they're incredibly talented people, or freedom of recovery. I mean, it's hard to. Recovery is so I mean, you're complicated. You're coming out of survival mode. I mean, what most people don't realize is they're suffering inside of a primitive state of surviving in a first world environment, which makes it really crazy. We function on such a higher level. We should be functioning on such a higher level to come out of that self-serving, self-defending state of mind is so liberating. It is like so easy. And I say this from experience. I mean, I have been suicidal and had chosen to commit suicide. I've been in a place where life, I'd rather die. It was really comforting to think about suicide. To a full and complete miraculous recovery, I would give up so much just to continue recovery. Any physical thing I would give up to maintain recovery, because it is such a, it really allows your life to be proliferate. I mean, you really get to be a kid in your state of being, no matter what age your body's in. You're open to life and what it can bring you. So it's like, well, you're going to find out it's going to be a win situation. Either way, you're going to be win-win.
Yeah, yeah. Well, a perfect example of that too, the mental, you know, aspect of how it changes on you, is that you know, my wife just recently got a new job where travel for us is a lot more easier to do. And so, you know, she's going to Spain here in February. She went to Ireland last year, and I've had really no interest in going. For one of the main reasons for that is because, well, I'm going to be flying overseas. And then, listen, we get over to Europe, they're, you know, not, I mean, everything's so small there. They, you know, small streets, small hotel rooms, small bathrooms. And I'm like, I don't fit there. So I didn't want to go. And now I'm like, I really want to go experience some of those places and see them. And I don't care about what's stopping me from going.
I love that. Well, and because if you have to lose weight first, Jeremy, you'll never go.
See, and that's exactly the thing, is that I thought that I needed to do that in order to make that happen, and now I don't care.
Yeah. Notice like, the I wanna go. By doing that on your food is way relaxed.
Yeah.
And it means that you don't have to be perfect, and you don't have to be, you know, well, you're on the protocol, but going back into reality, you're on a medical procedure. In reality, it just, the strain on food. Could you imagine having to, let's say, I have to be a certain size to go on this vacation, what that's going to do to your relationship with food. I mean, you are going to go into some serious primitive problems.
Well, yeah. And then it's, you know, it just gets multiple times worse when you have that breakdown and you give in.
Right. You know, or if you do succeed and you lose the weight, you're about to have a major binge issue when you get there and when you come home.
Yeah.
Because the pressure is going to blow. Yeah. Your need for food. And this is what, you know, when I said to you, you're competing two primitive survival mechanisms, one to belong and to be lovable in a pack. And the most important one being the need to feel safe and secure with food, because it's a physiological need to survive. The food is always going to win in the end, because we're wired from millennia of evolution to need food to survive. You don't need another body of a person to physiologically survive. You need it psychologically, because we're wired to be pack animals at this point, but you need food to live, right?
Yes.
You're going to get your food in the end.
Yeah.
These two compete. That's why 98% of all dieters, 95 to 98%, end up with compensatory emotional eating problems after a restrictive diet.
Hey, I'm done with my diet. I can go. We can go do whatever.
I deserve. So you're actually, all of those negotiations, it's a matter of your brain saying, get food, get food, get food. And you're trying to repress your shame about it. That's all you're doing. I feel bad. I shouldn't eat this. So let's repress it with, I deserve it. I've earned it. You know, that's what emotional eating is. It's trying to repress shame with excuses for why you should eat. Why are, you know, I don't want to demonize that. That's actually, when you take a step back and look at it, holy primitive brain working perfect.
Oh, yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that. It's just, it's meant to work in a third world environment. Right? scavenging, foraging,
right,
defending, stealing food, all of those things you would do if we were in a third world environment, but we're doing it in a first world environment.
Or when playing,
shaming people.
Or when playing World of Warcraft.
I mean
I appreciate you spending the time and helping give some clarity, you know, because it's a lot of males in particular have reached out, and it's one of those things where, you know, even in the Journal of Psychology, you know, they don't, I mean, the numbers that they have for binge eating is so small, and it's like, that's because half the people aren't reporting that they have a problem because they don't know that they have a problem, especially with us men. It's, you know, it can be a form of machismo to how much we can, you know, hunt, gather, and then eat. Gluttony is one of those things where, you know, we look at that and say, oh, look, you know, that's a great thing. You can take, for example, the eating competitions and things like that. And that's one of the things that really precipitated my knowing, okay, I'm not done, I got a problem, is I had a challenge between myself and a fella, the taco eating challenge. And we were really getting into it. And then my bosses were like, hey, you maybe you shouldn't do this. It's like, what? What are you? Like, oh my God, what am I? That's dumb. Why was I going to do this? So it's one of those things where I just, you know, I felt like I needed to do this in a public manner to help myself and other people. I think it's kind of the reason that I'm around, is I have that ability to be able to do that and reach some people, and hopefully, you know, they can make a difference in their lives like I have.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, and there's so much, the industry of, you know, as a gym owner and a personal trainer and my, you know, education and, you know, exercise science, it's, there's so much emphasis, on obesity and weight, partly because it's been demonized as something that's unhealthy. I remember, although in college, they were like, no, it's not unhealthy. Your body's supposed to gain weight. It's an association to these issues, and them talking about the height and weight charts and whatnot. But just being able to open your mind to the big picture that maybe it's not your carbohydrates that we should be focused on. Maybe that is just another way of saying Atkins diet. Keto, Atkins, I mean, it's all
zone,
the same thing.
Zone.
It's a new way to do the same thing with new flair and more egos wanting to say, it's the best, healthiest thing ever, all the science. Well, did you read all the science about shame and fear and fight or flight and blood sugar, especially with food?
That's too complicated.
It's really not, if they think, you know what I'm saying? It is and it's not, but there's so much evidence out there around just shaming people who have body fat. The amount of shame in the medical community. So by people getting educated and even you coming out and talking about this from this point of view, it's opening people up to see, oh, maybe I need to look at it differently rather than seeing that, oh, I need to lose weight. That to me is so juvenile. And I'm not judging that. I'm not judging it.
You're not judging. You're just pointing out.
Just saying it.
She's just pointing it out.
Maybe we should evolve here. There's a like 80 years of failure going on, and people are still doing the same thing.
Here's what you need to do: is you need to come up with some shiny packaging, because that's what I'm into. I'm into
the Metallica diet.
Yeah, but it's not a diet; it screws people up.
Yeah, but I made a huge mistake. I don't know. There's something about like the Metallica diet is look at yourself, not your weight.
Yeah,
look at your. You know, I don't know. I kind of like Metallica diet.
All right. Well, I like it too. And it's been great. Will it be successful? I think, I don't know. It's hard to say, you know, I'm doing this round of the HCG protocol. And when I first came up with this whole thing, I did have the HCG slated in there to maybe do, because at the time I felt like, well, that'll be a good test for me. But also I know you're going to lose weight.
Yeah.
It was an insurance policy, really. And then as we got closer to this, I was like, well, you know, to be perfectly honest with you, that probably isn't the best way to go. And then secondly, it's a good test to see if I have done my due diligence with the emotional part about it, listening to the hunger, and then identifying if there are some things I have left unnoticed.
Well, yeah. Well, and you've got to be able to not care about your weight.
You've got
to not care about the weight loss. And as you transition off of this protocol, you need to be okay with how the body responds to reality. Because this isn't reality right now. You're in like a...
Well, I've been through that. You know, yeah. I've seen how that is. And you know, understanding that, you know, yes, if you complete this and you're going to lose a certain amount of weight and things are going to, you're going to look different and all that, but it's probably going to come back. I've seen it come back. Yep. I mean, all I had to do is sniff some, you know, bread or some sugar and it'll happen like that, no matter how careful you're going to be. But, you know, that the point of getting through it and feeling like I'm kind of, it's a good test to see if I'm where I need to be.
Well, and so. A test to see if your weight is irrelevant to the goal. The goal should not be about your weight so much as it should be about, again, developing a sense of capacity and a sense of yourself that is not defined by your bigness or your thinness. Yeah. Either direction, you know, the big J. It doesn't matter if you're middle J or moderate J or little J. Why does that matter? You're still the same person.
Yeah.
Even if you were...
Well, I branded it Big J now, so we're staying there.
But even if you were to get hit by a car and you were paraplegic and you had to travel to Europe in a wheelchair, it's like, so is life not worthy of being experienced? Is it not worthy of a joy?
We didn't really talk about that. And so you're real quick. Yeah. I mean, that I actually contemplated that when I was on that plane trip. I was like, well, what if I was somebody who was handicapped and had...
Did they not deserve to go?
Right. Travel. Well, exactly. I had to take on that mentality of like, well, you know, this is life the way it is for them. That's the way it is. And, you know, it can't be easy if they would look at themselves in that shame kind of pity way. There's no way that they would be able to carry on a daily basis, I don't think, and mm-hmm. be successful.
No, they wouldn't. So, they have to go through an acceptance process. Anybody, if you know anybody who's had literal physical trauma, that's irreversible. There's an acceptance process. If you can't accept it, you're in misery. You're in complete misery. You're in loss and grief. And the only way to come out of that grief is through acceptance. Once you come to acceptance, now you've got this whole world of options relative to what you're capable of. Your capacity or your ability is free in this zone. But if you have to go back into what you can't do anymore and what you used to be able to do, you're screwed. You're going to feel like a victim. So in this case, it's like, well, just accept where you're at. If you can accept where you're at, you're not limited. Even if you're carrying around, let's just say for the rest of your life, you're going to be 350 pounds permanently forever, no matter what you do. You kind of like, okay, you go through an acceptance process. And then if you lose weight, do you really want to care? Do you want to care about losing weight?
Well, no, that would be bad.
Yeah. Some people listening to this might not get that. They're not going to get that.
But how you feel about that when that happens, and I'd have to imagine, and I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, we kind of touched on this a little bit with some of the hormones and things like that. And, you know, there's a set point and, you know, might not, you're going to gain weight back. The body wants you to gain the weight back.
It's going
to
do what it's going to do, whether you like it or not.
But if you take on, if you, you know, realistically recovered from this, you're obviously not eating the same amount of calories. It's not possible.
It's all relative to your overall hormones and who knows, right? And that's what I found out with all that medical or the hormonal testing I did originally.
Yeah. It would be crazy for me to, you know, feel recovered from, you know, emotional eating and binge eating, but then go on to continue to binge eat.
Oh yeah. That doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, you don't do that.
I mean, that's,
doesn't work.
That would be absurd. So,
even if you went to a third world environment, you would be aware of that mechanism so much more and have more control over it than you would, you know, now after you recover, you become aware of those mechanisms and the fact that it's a choice and it's based on perception, right? The perception of being deprived is a choice if you can be aware, right? So how do you lose that awareness once you're aware of it? Even if we were to go into a third world environment, would you go back into binge eating? Probably not.
Well, I'd probably get killed.
That's the truth. If we really want to get down to it.
They'd be like, hey, stop eating all the food. You're killing us.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's... But the reality is there's a way to contemplate and meditate and a way to be grateful for what you have and to share and to give.
Well, when you're this size, you really don't need much food.
You don't.
I mean, your body will tell you. If you're really listening and you're following that hunger scale...
You're pretty much hibernating right now.
Yeah, it's one of those things where there's plenty of stuff there. You don't need to eat very much. to mm-hmm. to live.
It's amazing. The whole thing is amazing.
Yeah.
It's really miraculous. If you were dying right now and could look back at your whole life, it's amazing. It's amazing what the body's done for you over the course of this learning process, evolving process, psychological, emotional evolution. The body's been like your biggest fan.
Maybe not my back. Maybe not my discs and my vertebrae. Right now, it's not. Stop it.
Hey, I have bulging discs, slip discs. I have all sorts of problems, and maybe it's not about your weight.
It's my posture.
Yeah. So is mine.
All right. Well, thank you, Robin, for spending this time with me and talking about it. And we'll have an update at some point about the hashtag Metallica diet.